to our first ever live podcast, Pell Droid. My name is Russell, and I am with...
Leon.
And Rich.
Thank you to Chapter. Thank you for everybody coming. Thank you to Ashley Drake from St. David's Press. And that is why we are here. It is to plug this book. It's Leon's book, Little Wonder. There's a funny story, that, not that funny, if I'm honest, but he just sort of dropped into a text, actually. So I said, oh, by the way, Russ, I'm going to do a book about Brian Flynn. Casually just sort of chucked that into a text exchange, I remember. And I thought, like a proper book. A book, yeah. And so the aim of today is to find out a little bit more about the book, a little more about the writing process, the research, any things that Leon kind of uncovered, unearthed, about a guy who's... I was amazed to hear that, or to learn that he didn't have a book, given that players have lots of books. Some players have 4 or 5 books about themselves by their age of 26 these days. And for Flynn, who's like a really important player, even more important coach and manager in Wales, with an affinity and affiliations to several clubs in several areas and parts of Wales, it was amazing that there wasn't already a book about him. So what was the inspiration?
Really, that I felt his contribution to Welsh football had been somewhat overlooked over the years, and someone had to do this book, and so I decided I would do it myself. And that's really, yeah, it's really interesting you saying that about him being a part of several clubs in Wales and different areas, and obviously he played for the national team as well. And so kind of telling the story of Brian Flynn has really been, to a large extent, telling the story of Welsh football over the past 45 years or so. Not that I wanted to stand on Phil Stead's toes, but that's just how it is. If you tell Flynn's story, you're telling the story of Welsh football, really, of recent times. And as a big Wales fan, I felt like if someone had done what he's done in Welsh football, in Welsh rugby, there probably would be 4 or 5 books about him already. I've joked a bit with Russ about that. And we're sort of just starting to catch up, really, with football, and there's been some good ones recently. That's really the main inspiration for doing it.
So what do people need to know about Brian?
What he did as intermediate team manager between 2005 and 2012. Now, that was my original idea. It was just to write about that period, which she turned into part 3 of the book. There are 3 very specific periods. There's part 1 is called You Can't Judge a Book by the Cover. It covers Brian's upbringing and playing career. Part 2 is called Big Boss Man. It's about his time managing Wrexham and Swansea. And part 3 is called Children of the Revolution. Because really, I felt he was like the father of the revolution in Welsh international football, which was going nowhere, really. And I've said, I think, in the intro to the book that really, you know, like John Toshack, I'll give Mark here will like this bit. But I think
AKA Tosh fan.
Oh, AKA Tosh fan. It's great to see you. Was the architect. But the thing is with Toshack, he's lived in Spain for decades, so he really needed someone on the ground who was going to sort of carry out this plan. And Flynn was, I've called him the master builder, because he was the one who was going to 12 games a week. He was the one who spotted these, you know, kids called Gareth Bale and Aaron Ramsey and Joe Allen and Chris Gunter when they were kids, and said, right, we're going to push them up to the under-21s, see how they go there. They do all right there, push them up to the seniors. And that's, you know, how so many of them were fast-tracked. But it's not just that. It's that he was going out and finding players with Welsh parents, grandparents, and broadening the player base. And so it meant we had a squad, you know, a serious squad, a proper squad. And I don't think we would have qualified for the Euros and had that experience, incredible experience last year, if we hadn't had a squad. I mean, I go back to the start of the qualifiers and the games against Bosnia and Cyprus at home. Aaron Ramsey and Joe Allen were both injured then, but Andy King and Dave Edwards came in. We ground out results. We ground out results because we had a squad, and we had a squad because of the work that Brian Flynn did. What meant that it turned into a sort of full biography, and I look back at his playing career and club management career, was really, it came from Ashley, from the publisher, first because we didn't want the book to be too similar to Chris Waffen's book, Together Stronger, which is an excellent book, which kind of looks at that period as well, more at the senior team than what was happening underneath with the under-21s and so on. But really, Ashley said, the thing is, it's all connected anyway, because he's making those contacts as a player, as a club manager, which means he's very well liked in football. He has access to clubs. He could go to clubs, talk to managers, to academy managers, to coaches, ask about Welsh qualified players, ask about the young Welsh players as well. Also, the fact that, you know, where did this guy take his inspiration from? Who were his influences in football? And I particularly had to look at Jimmy Adamson, who is his first manager at Burnley, who is very innovative and very highly thought of in the game. And I didn't really know much about him, but it was absolutely fascinating to learn more about him by reading books and what I heard from Brian as well. But I had to kind of look at that, really, because it is all connected.
And so one of those players, Chris Gunter, writes the preface in the book, and I've got it here. It's important to remember that Brian, our little wonder, played a huge role in the development and beginning of our Welsh pathway. And I think that's key, isn't it? It's not just the players, it's that whole kind of system. So when you talk about him being that master builder, that architect, that's a system that's in place now and is continuing to churn out talent. Maybe not in the numbers that we require to keep going forward, but it's getting there. And I think it's more than just this notion that we had some sort of lucky crop, some golden generation, that kind of bit of a cliche. That talent has been nurtured and developed and not just stumbled upon.
Absolutely. I think it is two things. It is, for starters, like the squad, as I said before, having that strength in depth. I think we probably have, well, over the last few years, we've had more strength in depth than we've ever had before. And I look at this in the book because there are all sorts of quotes. You can go back to the 70s, the 80s, in Craig Bellamy, I think, in the late 90s, talking about how the problem for Wales is if one or two players get injured, we've had it. And you need to do something about that if you want to do something in international football, because you're always going to have some injuries, some suspensions. That's one thing. And also, it's the players, I think, coming through together and identifying the talent early. It's kind of what happened with Wales. It's kind of what happened with Manchester United a little bit in the 90s, with this sort of class of 92 thing, where you kind of know these guys are coming through together. It was Gary Neville, and it was Scholes and Butt and Beckham, etc. They're mates, because they've come through together, they're the same age, like Ramsey and Gunter are like best mates. If you're friends, you go out into the field with your friends like that, you're more willing to fight for each other. And part of that, I suppose, is a little bit of luck, but that doesn't tell the whole story. That's an oversimplification.
But a Bale comes along once in a generation, and so there's an element of luck with that. But it's not luck to look at him, look at his attributes physically, his playing attributes, his character, and kind of go, he's not a left-back, which is what he'd been at Southampton, at Spurs. As much as Harry Redknapp likes to revise history around this, it's Flynn that's the first person to kind of go.
There was a really interesting thing. In John Toshack did a really interesting, fun interview this week where, amongst a lot of good points, he also suggested that he could see no reason why Bale couldn't go back to left back, which is kind of an eccentric, interesting view. You've kind of spent time with Brian Flynn. What would Brian Flynn say to that suggestion of Bale returning to left back now?
All I can really say is, I'll tell a story of like when he saw him for the first time, or when he was first in a Wales camp. Brian took over the job as intermediate manager in early 2005, and to get a kind of grip of who was in the system, basically decided to have a massive training camp and invite like the 60 or of the best youngsters in the system down to Swansea, and his coaches David Williams and Alan Curtis were there. You take 20, I'll take 20. In the first session, they just had some small-sided games and one-touch, two-touch football, playing without goalkeepers. And they were coming off this training session, and David Williams goes, like, who's that? Alan Curtis says, yeah, Brian, who is that kid there? And he goes, that's Bale from Southampton. I'll tell you something now, and you're not going to believe me. You know, like, what's that? And he goes, well, Southampton think he's a left back. What? You know, that was David Williams and Alan Curtis as well. And he was like, I'm serious, but Southampton think he's a left back? But I'm not going to play him there. No chance. Straight from the start, Flynn and Curtis and Williams thought he was either a winger or a centre forward. And so when he pushed him up to the under-21s a few months later, he played him on the left wing in a friendly against Cyprus. And he did great. He's not going back to left back, no way. I doubt that he would consider Bale as a left. He never considered Bale as a left back. This is despite the fact that even in 2010, Harry Redknapp thought Bale's best position was left back. This was after he'd scored a hat trick in the San Siro. Just seems bizarre to me. Toshack played him as a wing back, but he encouraged him to go forward. Flynn was really the first person to play him as a winger as a forward, so I doubt he would agree with those comments.
Well, I guess like expanding on that, when the opportunity came for Flynn to be, I guess, caretaker manager, clearly he wanted the job full-time of the senior team. I guess two kind of parts to the question: how much would it have meant to him to get the job full-time? And secondly, how would you see, had he got the job full-time, how would you see that of playing out for Wales?
In all honesty, I think his time when he should have got the job was 1995, when he was favourite for a job. Bobby Gould was given it. I think that's truly the worst decision in Welsh football history, to be perfectly frank. It's yeah, sorry to mention that name. I'll put some money in the swear jar. By this point, he'd had a bit of success with Wrexham and got us promoted, and we'd had a few good cup runs, and someone else could have come into Wrexham at that time and maybe taken the club on, because he'd got us facing in the right direction after years of it struggling, really. And that would have been the perfect time for him to take over the Wales job. I'm not going to criticise the FAW too much for not appointing him in 2010, because perhaps they would say they've been proved correct by wanting to go down a path of having a younger managers. Both Gary Speed and Chris Coleman have done well. Perhaps the players did need a younger manager, and we can all see that they responded. I honestly don't know how it would have gone if he'd got the job in 2010, but it was 15 years too late then anyway. It's interesting that he had a good relationship with Alex Ferguson, because he went to see Man United's reserves and youth teams play quite a lot when he was Wrexham boss, because he was living in Lancashire, and so he would go on the way to Wrexham, he would go down to the Cliff, United's training ground. There's no way of knowing, but I speculate that perhaps Ryan Giggs could have had a better international career had Flynn taken over in 95 rather than Gould, and that we could have had shock results. If Wrexham could beat Arsenal, West Ham, Lingby, Ipswich when they were Premier League, Middlesbrough when they were Premier League, I don't see why Flynn's Wales team couldn't perhaps have beaten Belgium or Holland. He was a master of shock results. That would have been the time for me, I think, for him to take the job.
Okay, kind of just kind of on a similar kind of vein, I don't know whether you discussed this with him or whether you would have an inkling, but I'm sorry to put you on the spot here, Leon. Who would you feel Flynn would have as a preferred choice to take over as manager now? Or whether that would be a combination of a couple of people. If so, which order would that combination
have you
be in?
Have you been on Twitter this afternoon, Rich?
No, it's been spoken.
Yeah.
Oh, what's he said?
Giggs, sadly.
This is me being speechless. you won't hear my voice again for the rest of the podcast. Okay, what did he say? Does Brian Flynn have a Twitter account?
No. No, okay. He doesn't. No. We were at the Liberty Stadium earlier. He was doing some signings at lunchtime, and he was like pulled out by Ian Hunt from the BBC, and I can only presume that's when they asked him. Because it was on Twitter this afternoon that Giggs was by far the best candidate, he thinks. I may perhaps understand why he wouldn't be so keen on Bellamy, because Bellamy didn't play for him when he was temporarily...
And that was quite pointed.
Wales,
I believe,
manager.
Wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, he played for Cardiff City at the time.
Yeah.
Bellamy was really pining for speed. The only way probably Bellamy would have carried on playing international football was if Gary Speed was appointed at that time, I think. That was part of it. So perhaps that was a little sort of dig at Bellamy to say, no, Giggs is the best candidate. He knows Giggs. We've had some Twitter exchanges where you've kind of put a case forward for Giggs without, you know, him being your preferred candidate.
But it was, I need to clarify this, it was a theoretical contrarian argument that I made myself put forward.
I'm not trying to say that you want Giggs, but no. There is a way you can kind of justify it. But he's by far preferred candidate. It's interesting, I did a thing in London the other day with Ellis James and at the London Welsh Centre, and I was asked who I would prefer, and I said, for me, Bellamy or Ossian Roberts, equally, really. And Ellis James said the same, and then he opened it up to people. There was maybe like 25 people in the room, and he asked, is there anyone who would want Giggs? And there was not one. And I think amongst the core Wales support, and Mark was saying this before we started recording, there really isn't very much support for Giggs at all. Slightly flabbergasted by those comments, but there you go.
No, it's interesting. I guess it's like an insight. When you hear kind of, I guess, your like really low level, I guess like savage level pundits, you're reluctant to listen to them. But I guess when Brian Flynn says something that might not be immediately palatable or easy to take on board, I guess you do have pause for thought then. I would be interested in hearing him expand on that. That's really interesting.
As a player, you don't get to play for Manchester United for 23 years in the first team without being dedicated to the game and being very professional, and I think, you know, you've seen that side of Giggs. he's someone who, in a club sense, the players, the young players would aspire to be like. Absolutely. You know, I'm sure they'd all love to win as many medals as him. It's just, for me, his Wales career was a disappointment considering his level of talent. He never sort of dragged the team along the way that Bale did in qualifying for the Euros. We're kind of always waiting for that level of performance from Giggs, and it just never came on a sort of regular basis, and where he could kind of win games almost single-handedly.
No, I agree. I mean, and I think as well, kind of going back to that John Toshack article, I believe Toshack picked Bale over Giggs in his best ever 11 that he's managed, which I guess speaks to what you're saying there. This has just popped into my head, kind of thinking about Toshack and different management careers. Did Brian Flynn ever have any aspirations to coach abroad? Because it seems like you would think that would be an interesting idea for him.
Well, he got his start in coaching in Limerick in Ireland, so...
Okay, yep.
Does that count?
I was perhaps thinking more kind of along your La Liga or kind of in the Netherlands or Germany, perhaps, but did he speak of that, or did he have any opportunities to do that?
No, what's interesting, really, is that he's lived in Burnley since he was 15, and it became a bit of a problem at Wrexham towards the end. When results are going well, that's fine. You can live wherever you want if the team's winning. Teams get into FA Cup quarterfinals. When the cup run sort of dried up a bit, it becomes a problem, and it became a bit of a problem with the crowd at Wrexham that he didn't live in the area. His wife is from Burnley, and he's always felt very at home there since he went up there at age 15. And that was kind of part of the... Well, it was the main problem, really, at Swansea, because he'd sort of turned that club around, really, and brought some great players to the Swans and saved them from relegation. They were kind of... They had a really good cup run the next season. He'd brought in people like Trundle and Martinez and Leon Britton, doing all right in the league. There was no chance of them getting relegated. And, you know, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, him and Kevin Reeves, his assistant, left the club. It was because they refused to permanently move to the area. Having said that, Hugh Jenkins, the chairman, was at pains to point out that they'd only seen like 100% commitment from them. And, you know, Flynn said this himself. His wife barely saw him when he was a club manager. He spent 5 or 6 nights a week staying in hotels, and he would just like go home after a game on a Saturday night and spend Sunday with her. But wives of football managers are football widows, that's what he said. So he spent a lot of time down in Swansea, but at that time they wanted the manager to actually have a house there. So if he wasn't prepared to move from Burnley to move back to South West Wales, where he's from, then I don't think that was ever on the cards to go abroad, actually, no.
Well, can I just, touching on Swansea, when you kind of hear about retrospective pieces on the Swansea Revolution and so on, you don't really hear Brian Flynn's name that much. Typically, it's kind of Martinez is the starting point, Hugh Jenkins has mentioned a lot. Does Brian have any opinion on this? Does he have any feeling on that? And what was the biggest thing he did as part of his Swansea, the beginning of that kind of big, big phase for them?
Well, it was a great chapter to write about. It's only one chapter because he was only there 18 months. And I called that chapter The Ugly Duckling, which I really like the name of, because that's what the club was at the time. They were bottom of the league. They had a ropey squad of players, I'll put it politely. Clearly not good enough. And a few weeks into the job, they lost at home 4-0 to Kidderminster. And in the film Jack to a King, James Thomas talks about this. They're in the dressing room, and the police came to the dressing room and said, you better stay in there for an hour because there's a crowd outside who want to kill you, basically. That was rock bottom. What he did then, well, this is why I think he's pretty unique as a manager. And 99% of managers probably would have gone to like a Premier League club and said, right, who's your 6'4" centre forward in your reserves? Can we have him on loan? And gone to another Premier League club and said, we'll have that big striker as well. We're gonna boot it up to the strikers, and we're gonna battle our way out. We're gonna fight our way out of this hole. Flynn went out and got 5'5" West Ham youth team player Leon Britton and Roberto Martinez, and said, right, we're gonna try and pass our way out of this, which they did, by the skin of their teeth. But surviving, just to survive in the league, meant that Leon Britton stayed and became a permanent player there. He was just there on loan. Roberto Martinez signed then as well. They wouldn't have signed for the club if they'd been in the conference. There's absolutely no way. There's no way of knowing what Swansea would have become had they gone to the conference then. So the biggest thing was to keep them in the Football League. But then the following season, when they realised they needed something a bit different, was when they went out and got Lee Trundle from Wrexham. We'd just been promoted back to the third tier, but they persuaded him to come to Swansea, and he's probably the greatest sort of cult hero that Swansea City have ever had, really. Got them facing in the right direction. I think you're right that history tends to look at Martinez as the start of the Swansalona thing, which was a big thing for a few seasons, and Brian's role was a bit overlooked, and I kind of wanted to try and redress that in the book a little bit. And I think perhaps he did feel like, talk quite a lot about Swansea, perhaps he did feel like his role was a bit overlooked. But I mean, he's back at the club working as a scout there now. And I spoke to Alan Curtis for the book, and he was saying, yeah, there is a recognition from people at the club that what Brian did back then was absolutely vital for Swansea going forward, and they wouldn't be in the Premier League now if it wasn't for what Brian did.
I've got one question, and we maybe throw it open to people if they've got any. Going back to Flynn as the player, and I didn't realise this until you told me this when we were having a chat as we were writing this. When he'd finished playing for Wales, he won 66 caps. He was only about 28, 29?
Yeah.
Which is kind of remarkable. Barely missed a game. And I didn't realise this then until today, actually, when we were down in Swansea with him. When he finished, he was second on the all-time caps list for Wales. And I love all those sort of stats. But to finish at 28, 29 and to think, well, for a start, you could have become, only another two or three games would have become the all-time leading cap, and was still a good player, playing at a decent level. So what happened there?
Yeah, it was interesting. I kind of had to bring that up with him because I thought it was a bit weird. Because we say now, when people are 27, 28, that they're coming into their prime, that's like when we expect players to be at their best. You know, that's Gareth Bale is 28 now. Okay, yeah, he's injured at the moment, but we think this is the prime of someone like Joe Allen or Aaron Ramsey. But this was when, this is, you know, the same age that Flynn played his last cap. When I brought this up with Brian, he said, well, I did, you know, I carried on playing. I was playing for Wrexham still in my mid-30s, which he was. But I was like, yeah, but why did you play your last First Division game age 27? Why your last Wales game at age 28? And he kind of wasn't so forthcoming about that. And I put some reasons forward why I thought that would be. And if you look at it, there's quite a lot of top-flight careers back then that ended earlier. I was watching a lot of footage on YouTube from the 70s and 80s. Pitches were appalling. That's one for starters. Tackling was agricultural. That would be another reason. You had endless like cup replays. You could have like an FA Cup tie that would last for six games because they didn't go to penalty shootouts then. You didn't have squad rotation. That's a new concept. You'd have the first choice 11, and if you're like half fit, you play. So you kind of see it. You know, people like Toshak last played for Wales, I think, 28 as well, something like that. There's quite a few. So that's why I think it is. And he said, well, if I was playing now, I think I'd have won 100 caps for Wales. And I think he probably would have done because he only missed seven games between his first and his last cap. But it was less than 10 years that his international career lasted for.
Whose place in our current team would he have taken?
Is an interesting one because I've got a quote in the book from Leighton James who said, I can think of no higher compliment for Joe Allen than to say he's the closest thing I've seen in modern football to my old Wales teammate Brian Flynn. So I don't know, maybe those two would have had a battle to see who would have started, or maybe they would have played alongside each other. But if you want to know what he was like as a player, Joe Allen. Although Flynn did score seven goals for Wales, and was, I think Joe only has two at the moment.
Two Joe Allens would have been phenomenal against Ireland, particularly. Presumably, could not have killed both of them. He would have given us that kind of complete midfield of players who could all do the kind of the transitions and kind of really move, recycle the ball really well.
That's what I put this to Alan Curtis as well when I spoke to him, and he said, "Yeah, they're both players who sort of give their teams rhythm and momentum and transition from defence to attack and just have a great range of passing, long and short, and just all action." That's the thing with the book, and I tried to do this with the kind of writing style. I don't know if I've succeeded, but it's this, like, you watch Flynn playing, it's this, like, perpetual motion thing. It's just, like, non-stop, and it's just, it's all action. All action. And the book, hopefully, it moves quite quickly, and it's not a particularly long book, but it's still quite detailed, and I kind of like tried to have that focus that he had for football in the writing of the book, whilst the action still moves quite quickly. And I read something recently, someone, a biographer, saying that a book takes on the personality of its subject, and so that's kind of what I try to do in the writing.
Any questions for Leon? Mark's gone, and Mark's a Swans fan. I was particularly interested in Mark's view about, amongst fans, is there still a recognition and a legacy maybe of his, albeit brief, spell? Because he does get overlooked. I think that's always grossly unfair. As does Kenny Jackett, actually, as an aside. Yeah,
it seems to be lonely.
Yeah, to a certain extent, but he sometimes gets mentioned. It's like, we'll give some credit to the fancy, handsome continental coaches, but we'll airbrush out the domestic, homegrown coaches.
I know Ellis James, who's a big Swansea fan, thinks that Kenny Jackett, by getting them out of the bottom division and winning the Football League trophy, or whatever it was called, he has very fond memories of that Kenny Jackett team, actually, and thinks that a bit unfairly overlooked, actually. The film Jack to a King, which is an excellent film, it doesn't even mention Kenny Jackett, I don't think. No mention at all. And Flynn is mentioned, but I think he's sort of quite overlooked, because they do tend to concentrate on Roberto Martinez and Brendan Rodgers particularly.
I was going to say, Mark, I didn't want to put you on the spot, but back in the room, in terms of Flynn as a Swans manager and being a Swans fan, does he get the recognition amongst fans, do you think, for his part in the whole kind of, first rescue and then the whole kind of revival of the club? Because there's a feeling from maybe non-Swans that he does maybe get a little bit overlooked.
My personal view is there's this terminology that's not always popular between core fans and others. If you were to survey the core fans, those that have the highest propensity to follow the team in good or bad times, I think personally that Flynn does get the recognition. However, at the risk of snookering myself, what people would say is it was Flynn who signed Trundle, Liam and Martinez, but the Martinez period did take Swansea onto another level. So whilst there might be a risk of snookering myself there, I don't think it is a big contradiction. I think it is possible to take what I think most core Swansea fans do acknowledge the contribution Flynn made. When he came in, it was quite a mess. Swansea had wrongly, in my opinion, sacked Colin Addison, who I thought was a good manager. Flynn did a good job, not only in terms of the players, but a bit like the Toshak years, the greatest achievement was not so much the player development, but the change of brand. Flynn had also instigated a change in the way Swansea played. I've never been to a game in my life where we've lost 3-0, but still have played the other side. And I remember going to Oxford when it was a relatively new stadium at the time, and Swansea had outplayed them that day but lost 3-0. And I remember thinking, there's some cause for optimism here. So personally, I think if you do survey the core Swansea fans who've been there in the darker times, I think Flynn does get the acknowledgement. But if you were to listen to the wider media profile of what happened in the Swansea story, like Richard said earlier, the time seems to
have
begun from when Martinez took.
Yeah, I've put a lot of credits in the book Martinez's way because of that style of football, which was just... I remember watching FA Cup game against Fulham when they were at Swansea at home. I think they were in the Championship at the time under Martinez. And it ended 1-1, but it was incredible to see a Premier League team. It was Roy Hodgson was Fulham manager. It just completely outplayed, just outpassed. Hodgson was on the touchline. He looked like he did there in that Iceland game at the Euros. He just didn't have a clue what was going on and how to change it.
Had to get the Iceland game in, didn't we, for the couple of the interlopers?
Yeah. The Swans alone, I think that was Martinez. Yeah, but who brought Martinez to the club in the first place? So Flynn was perhaps the catalyst for that, even though the whole Swansea media loving sort of did come later on. Yeah.
What's the official Barry Horn's view on Brian Flynn?
I'd like to, always thought so highly, and I feel a bit relieved that Flynn's been written into the history of Welsh football by the art, so I think that's a really fantastic contribution you're making. But you talk about Flynn, the manager, the player. What about the man? He strikes me as a very modest man. No,
he is very modest. There's a line in the book which is something like, Flynn and Toshak's egos are comparable to their physical sizes. Toshak, I could get a few sort of digs in there, but I do appreciate in the bigger picture what Toshack did because he was the architect. I say that in the book. But no, he is humble. The fact that he was happy for me to write his life story, I'm not a professional journalist, didn't really kind of have aspirations to write about football full-time or anything like that. And all of a sudden I've got this guy sort of calling me up, leaving messages on my phone. I'm like, wow, telling him, sorry, I've got to take my son to kindergarten. I've just kind of cut off a guy who scored against Brazil. He scored against Man United at Old Trafford, you know. And it was just like, whoa, and he's calling me. The first time I spoke to him at length, he was, this, you know, tells the story of what he's like, really. It was later that morning when I did get some time to call him, and he was at an Accrington Stanley youth game. I think Rochdale were the opponents, something like that. Yeah. It's a big glamour fixture, that one. And I knew that he'd been employed by Everton when Roberto Martinez came in as manager to scout youth players. So I said, oh, is this part of your role at Everton, scouting? And he was like, no, I left a few weeks back when Ronald Koeman came in. I'm just keeping my eye in. Here's a guy who, you know, when he's unemployed, goes to watch Accrington Stanley youth games on a Tuesday morning. He loves football. It's genuine. It's like a genuine love of the game of footballers. He's not bitter about modern players earning a lot more money than he did back in the day or anything. He speaks that same sort of like twinkle, that spark in his eye about Gareth Bale or Joe Allen or Aaron Ramsey as he does when he talks about great players he played against and you know, Liam Brady, Brian Robson. He's not, oh, everything was better in my day at all. I think he was just happy that, perhaps a bit surprised. I got the feeling he was surprised someone wanted to write a biography of him, and I don't have any complaints at all about what he was like with me. He was just great. I took phone calls. We met up for 4 hours to talk face to face, but and then a lot of phone calls as well to kind of ask him about stuff I'd forgotten about. He is just, you know, remarkably humble.
Sorry to cut in, but when we were speaking to him earlier, I'd sort of he'd made the point of sort of saying, well, I've only met Leon the once, and I was going to meet him for about an hour, and I'm thinking, well, as if your life is going to and your playing and coaching career can kind of be condensed and it can be done justice in an hour.
Yeah, no, it was 4 hours that we actually were face to face, and that was just great because he can talk. You know, he's good. Like, he's very funny. He's a good talker. Just mention a name, say, oh, so just go, okay, so Gareth Bale, and then he was off. Yeah,
Mickey Thomas.
Well, you're certainly off there. Yeah,
we can't go there though with a couple of those stories. I mean, those are for afterwards, guys downstairs. Seriously, but it was a great one about Ramon Caliste. And you've got to be a real kind of Welsh football obsessive expert. Let's use the word expert, just to retain just some semblance of dignity. And he's at United. You were saying this today, wasn't he? Yeah. He's at Manchester United as a youth player. He's a Cardiff boy, all talent, little attitude. And he gets released at United. And so Brian was saying, with all young players that got released, he said, give me a list of three clubs, just three clubs, and I will see what I can do to get your foot in the door and maybe get a contact. And he said, so Caliste came back and he had... And he's based in the northwest of England, yeah. Liverpool, and there was a couple of other sort of Premier League clubs, yeah, in the northwest, so it was Everton, Manchester City, whatever. And Brian sort of said, I had in mind Bury, and which probably says more about Ramon Caliste,
oh, yeah,
and his inflated sort of self-opinion than anything else. But I think we learned today that he's selling luxury designer watches.
Watches, selling watches.
He's on Twitter.
Is he Ramon Caliste? Okay. Twitter. Wow.
But that bizarre. Kind of says a lot, isn't it? It was like, okay, guys, you know, you're young players, you're promising. Is that maybe that first sort of fall at a hurdle?
Yeah.
And I will do what I can to get.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting as well, that he was a youth star for Wales. He was the captain of the Welsh schoolboy team, playing even like a year, playing with older kids, you know, aged like 14. He was captain in the Welsh schoolboys. So, you know, it's just incredible for a guy his size. So big clubs were after him. As a player, Arsenal, Tottenham, Chelsea. But he went to Burnley and he saw the training ground at Gawthorpe Park, which was renowned as probably being the best training ground in Britain at the time. And another thing he said was, you know, he knew he'd get his chance there. And he wasn't blinded by the lights of the big clubs. I think it was a sign of how astute he was at a young age that he was prepared to go to. You know, Burnley were first division, don't get me wrong. But they weren't never been a glamour club. You know, it's a small town. It's only slightly bigger than Port Talbot, Burnley. That's what he was like. So, you know, he would say to players when they were released, when he was intermediate manager, you know, help me out here. Give me some clubs you might be interested in the area and level you think you might be at. Yeah, Calise. Well, I think it was a telling of his sort of inflated sense of his own ability as a kid that, you know, he would only consider Premier League teams at that time. When, if you look at Joe Allen came up through Swansea as a lower league player and you know, Bale and Ramsey were in the Championship. Ashley Williams, Hedson Town and Stockport, and a lot of our best players worked their way up, really, and yet kind of had to fight to get to the level that they're at. There's a chapter called Attitude, Intelligence, Ability, because those are the three things you look for in young players, and it was sort of attitude and intelligence first, really. Ability was a secondary concern.
Can I ask Derek, did you ever see Flynn play? Because a little bit polite now, being older.
Oh, yeah. I thought he was outstanding, personally speaking, but I think it was probably the players that was around him. Personally speaking, if he'd had better players, he'd have probably done a lot better.
Yeah.
Same with Giggs, you could compare Giggs. Like, I'm a United supporter, but I want Giggs to be your manager. I think it could do anything for you. Because if United is surrounded by brilliant players, simple as that, really. You have to have players.
You and Rich would get on brilliantly.
Well, no, I remember Roy Keane did an interview where he said Giggs wasn't a great player. He was a player who had a great career. It's exactly what you're saying. You're surrounded by kind of geniuses and really focused winners. All he had to do was kind of be a professional and survive, which he kind of did. But I'm really interested in this kind of idea of Brian Flynn as a man. And I guess as human qualities, it can be good to be humble. It can be good to be grounded. Do you think, and this isn't meant as a criticism, do you think perhaps a lack of ambition or a lack of drive stopped him from reaching his potential both as a player and possibly a manager as well? And kind of second to that, do you think his commitment to a certain aesthetic of playing meant he didn't win as many games as a manager as he could have done? Thinking about him as a Brian Flynn as a man, did he just enjoy football too much to the detriment of winning?
I got the impression that winning perhaps wasn't the be-all and end-all with him. Like I said before, he loves football. He loves watching good football. And you see that as a player, the passing triangles, 1-2s. That's what he imprinted on the teams he managed as well. And the under-21s just played some absolutely like outstanding stuff when he was manager. Just outplaying the likes of Italy, France, large periods in the game against England at Villa Park. And there was an England team full of Premier League players, and he had just a bunch of kids from Swansea, Cardiff, Bristol Rovers, etc. And but they just pass it around so sort of beautifully. It's great to watch. But no, he didn't have Cristiano Ronaldo style focus on winning. That's for sure.
Was he an intelligent?
Yeah, absolutely.
Could he transfer what he thought to other players?
Absolutely, I think the players responded to him, which is not always easy to do. Absolutely, players all speak very highly of him, players who played under him, and they don't always speak highly of Toshak. But having said that, Toshak was a winner as a player. He won trophies at Liverpool, he won La Liga, he won the Copa del Rey with Sociedad. Perhaps you do need that level of ego to actually go and win things, and maybe that possibly did hold him back, to answer your question, that lack of ego in a sense. But it's perhaps why he was better behind the scenes as the intermediate manager, and it might not have worked out if he'd been given a shot as the Wales manager. Yeah, but obviously we'll never know.
Did he mention about the other day he approached that didn't accept the offer, or people who qualified that maybe didn't fulfil their potential or got an injury?
Mm. Yeah, I did ask about that, actually. I asked if he missed out on anyone he knew as Welsh qualified.
Yeah.
And he actually, we talked a little bit about a guy called Rhys Williams. I don't know if you remember him. He played for Middlesbrough. He was from Australia, actually, with a Welsh grandmother, a Welsh grandfather, perhaps. But he went to Australia. And that was interesting, because Brian actually said he wasn't actually that convinced by him when he had him for the under-21s. He wasn't sure if he was going to be a centre-back or a midfielder as well. He's someone who's been injury-prone anyway. He's played, I think, 14 times for Australia. I don't think he's ever played in a World Cup. He plays for Perth Glory now, that's his hometown. So perhaps we didn't really miss out there in the end. Player he mentioned who he thought would go on to have a much better career than he did was Daniel Elfie of of Swansea City, who was a fullback. I don't know what happened there. A lot of people say the same. I think he might be back in the Football League now with Yeovil, someone like that. He was at Aberystwyth for a while in the Welsh Premier League. But he was someone he really thought had a great attitude and had all the attributes to make it. It just, you know, sometimes just doesn't happen for players. I don't think he had any bad injury problems either. Just perhaps there's a player ahead of you at the club you're at, and it's difficult to get past them. Someone like Angel Rangel at Swansea was the first choice fullback, right back for years, and found it hard to get past him into the team. I asked him about James Chester because he was one of the Welsh qualified players who came sort of into the setup later on. He didn't actually know that James Chester had a Welsh mum. I'm sure if he had known, he would have been onto him and just relentlessly kind of trying to persuade him to come on board, because that's what he did with Hal Robson-Kanu. It took about a year to get him to come and play for Wales.
Mark?
It was a supplementary. I do remember a BBC article of under-21 players to watch for the future. And two of the defenders that Flynn cited, one of which was Darcy Blake, who's filled many a Welsh thread, quite a sad end to his career, and Lewin Nyatanga. Yeah. I just wondered if those two feature in any way, and if he talks about their lack of fulfilled potential.
Those players are mentioned as being part of some really good under-21 teams for him. I mentioned Nyatanga as being someone who didn't perhaps fulfil his potential, but also I think he was someone, because he was pushed up to the seniors so early, he was a sign of someone who showed that Toshack perhaps lacked options, in that he'd fallen out with a few people or a few people had just chosen to retire anyway, and perhaps he wasn't ready to be an international regular but was pushed into it anyway because we were lacking experienced players at the time. And I think once Ashley Williams really came into the team and became a regular, he was sort of slightly on the way out, even though he's a bit younger than Ashley Williams. I think that's something that I kind of put forward rather than Brian himself. The fact that Darcy Blake hasn't had a good football career is Darcy Blake's issue. Darcy Blake is responsible for Darcy Blake's career. If you don't want to do what it takes to be a professional footballer, doesn't matter how much talent you have, then you're not going to be a professional footballer. There are lifestyle issues there. Like I said, he looks at people's attitude as being a key factor in making it as a professional footballer. And that's why he was surprised that Daniel Alfie didn't make it, because he had a great attitude, apparently. But to expand a little bit, it was not great to kind of have to bring this up, but we did have to mention Ched Evans, because Ched Evans was just an outstanding player for him at under-21 level, 13 goals in 13 games. But circumstances dictated that he didn't go on to fulfil anything like his potential. But, I mean, to hear Flynn talk about what he was like as a player, as a kid, he compared him to Alan Shearer, had everything as a striker, the Welsh Shearer, that's what Flynn thought.
Yeah, go on. Yeah, Sheep Shearer. Yeah.
Going back to managers, with what he knows now, do you think Mark Hughes, if he gets fired this weekend, do you think he might be in the front?
If or when?
Russell.
His first spell as Wales manager. No, his spell. Let's not say first spell. I'm editing that out. His spell as manager, his only spell as manager, is, I think, exaggerated. He had a purple patch of about 9 or 10 months. Before that, it was quite barren. It took a long time for him to get to grips with it. And it fell apart quickly. And he only ever had eyes on the prize, just the top team, the first team. That was all he was interested in. The rest of it just was continuing to just decay and to rot. And so that's when Toshack then came in. Where are the players? There's just nothing coming through. One or two players, in spite of that system. So if Hughes is prepared to actually have the job on the basis of not just as the manager of the national team, but the manager of football in Wales, well, okay, maybe. My gut feeling is I don't think he'd be that interested. He's at that phase now, I think, in terms of age, in terms of his career, he's more interested in securing a legacy and at all costs. And if that means he's got to go to Porthmadog or to Fishguard to sit down with fans in the same way that Coleman really racked up the miles to do, to engage with people, I just cannot see Hughes, and several others for that matter, I just can't see Hughes now doing that, because I just don't think that fits with his MO, to be perfectly honest. He may have it tactically, and I only say may actually, You know, he has got a lot of experience under his belt. He's clearly a player that is still really, or an ex-player that's really well respected, I think. I'm just not sure he's got the hunger to actually do this. And that's important. That's what this job needs. That's not what other countries' job needs. There's other countries that don't need that, but our country does. And so you've got to be able to do all of that. And the CV, the job description, is quite lengthy in that regard. And I just don't think he'd have the guts for it, the appetite.
Yeah, managing us, for Mark Hughes, he'd be on probably 1/10 of his salary. He could get as a club manager. I think it's a very specific kind of person who finds managing Wales appealing. You can't be interested in earning a lot of money, because by the standards of a manager, they earn virtually nothing managing us. So for me, I'd be looking at someone younger, someone hungry, like Russ is saying, someone who can connect with younger players, kind of the three amigos who came on against France. If I'm kind of getting into the mentality of Ampadu or Woodburn, I'd find Craig Bellamy, for example, more relatable to me. I personally would find Craig Bellamy more relatable to me than I would Mark Hughes, who I guess is a more dour, conservative kind of manager. The last thing we need is a manager who's on a downwards career trajectory. Because I think once you start on that downwards trajectory, you don't really come back up from it, typically. And like Russ says, I think he would have to have been sacked by Stoke, sacked by his next club, and probably not really thinking about managing a club again. In other words, out of options also. So for me, Mark Hughes would absolutely not be the guy or woman. He would not be the person to do the job.
Yeah, same. He was like my hero as a kid, really. So it pains me to say this. It sort of disappoints me what he's become actually now as a manager. It just refusing to shake people's hands at the end. It seems really petty, and he just seems a bit just like a really grumpy old man, spoiling my sort of image of him, like, you know, rising up to head height to like ping that ball back of the net against Spain. That was the first game I went to. No, I don't think he's the right man for us, for all the reasons that Rich just explained just then.
Football managers with close connections to Wales that may be considered, like Martinez, something like that.
Martinez is a Belgian anyway, so I think he's got his hands full there.
I mean, there was a brief kind of wild card of anyone who'd been trained at the FAW for their kind of coaching, so that would be
Peter Crouch.
Yeah.
Freddie Lundberg.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of kind of these interesting guys, but again, they would have to be in the right space to want to do that, be inclined. And this is why actually Oshan Roberts would be a really interesting choice as head coach for me, because as the guy who runs the coaching, presumably he will have good relationships with the guys who've done the coaching course, and he will also have insight into who actually are the really interesting, innovative coaches who've done it. So he might be able to pick out a coach who we haven't heard of, who maybe works in, I don't know, like for the reserve, like a reserve team in the MLS or something. So I think Oshan, from that point of view, could be a really interesting choice because of his breadth of knowledge of undiscovered coaches or perhaps famous former players who've done the coaching course who might not have yet got work. And I'd be interested to see whether Oshan would be looking to perhaps have Bellamy with him as an assistant. That would be really interesting to me.
Bellamy ever strikes me as sort of guy who's an assistant, if you know what I mean.
I would probably say, I mean, he's doing the kind of the youth team thing at Cardiff. You could say to Bellamy, you're the assistant with a view to you being at the end of this four-year cycle or this tournament cycle even. Kind of the way forward for me is to look at, I guess similar to how perhaps Germany do it, where you have like not quite a fixed cycle for a head coach, but the coach knows how long he's got in the job, basically, barring any kind of disasters. So, yeah, potentially for me, you'd get Bellamy involved and you might say, progress, learn, and you will be the next head coach.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to appoint Oshan Roberts because it would be like a Mourinho-style appointment, wouldn't it, where you're picking someone who wasn't a great player but just served his time and kind of worked his way into that position. I've got a lot of respect for those kind of people, more than someone like Ryan Giggs, who just seems to think because he's a big name that he deserves big jobs. The idea that he was going to be Manchester United manager just because he played for the club seems slightly absurd to me in this sort of day and age. We've moved beyond that kind of the days of just appoint the club great, because it's gone wrong so many times for Premier League clubs. So that's why that stopped happening. But I think Giggs in his head still thinks that's how it should be.
We're going to end it there for the purpose of the podcast. I'm relieved. I was worried we're going to have to end it on Ched Evans. Okay. And that's never a good note to end it on. So we're going to plug the book. It's available online at the St. David's Press website. I'm looking at Ashley, Amazon as well. It's going to be available online at... The cliche is all good bookshops, yeah?
And some bad ones.
I want to personally wish Leon all the best. As I said, I know how much time and effort and energy and blood and sweat and tears has gone into it. So all the best to it. It's lovely to kind of... We've only met about 3 times ever, I think, actually. In person, anyway.
Yeah,
I mean, over Skype any number of times doing these podcasts. Thank you for coming down. There are signed versions of the book. We had any number of editions signed.
Anyone here who wants to buy a copy deserves a signed one, yeah. Thank you so much for coming down. No, I really appreciate that. It's niche, I guess. Someone like Brian Flynn is not a big man, not a big name. But I really felt his story should be told, and no professional journalist would probably do it.
I'll reiterate what I said on Twitter earlier today. I read Leon's articles online for Vice, for The Guardian, in bed with Maradona. I think he is, for me, I think there could be any argument about this, he's the most interesting and relevant Welsh writer on sport, particularly on Welsh sport as well. I think he's fantastic. This is a great book. You kind of find a truth to the story. But also there's kind of a lot of really, really deep, deep level data and statistics in it, which again is really fun as well. But kind of you balance that with like the humanity, and I feel like you kind of really understood who Brian was, and I think it's a fantastic book. Does him absolute justice.
Thanks a lot, Rich, for that. Does that count when it like comes from your friend? I don't know. Like, but thank you anyway.
It absolutely counts. It absolutely counts.
How long did it take you, Rich?
The actual writing of it was about 5 months, but I'd started reading books for research before that. But in terms of like sitting down and writing most days for a few hours, it was roughly 5 months, yeah. It's not a particularly long book, but it is quite detailed. It's something that people have mentioned, that it has good detail to it. That's kind of how I wanted it to be. I didn't want it to waffle on. I wanted to have focus, like I said before, and to be a reflection of Brian's personality, his character, and his love of football.
Thank you. Diolch yn fawr. Let's retire to the bar and we'll share some of these Mickey Thomas stories, yeah?
Be happy and contented. People really must be the most useless.